Blog Talk Radio.
That was Andre Botticelli and Our Father. In honor of Paula and Crystalline and Andre back from Yosemite and the Grizzly Giant, where we stood together and listened to that beautiful song being sung, in honor of our Lord and Master, Jesus Christ, Michael of Nevadon, And thanks for indulging me, you guys, in that. And thank you, Diane, for creating that wonderful event, Diane Lebrecht, that we also thoroughly enjoyed. And guess what? You're on Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen, and we have a really great show for you today, which is with Larry and Joan Mullins. Larry is with us. Joan Batson-Mullins may be coming on a little later, but we're going to be talking about Larry's amazing, and Joan's amazing work, The Chronicle of Jesus, The Greatest Life Ever Lived. This is a work in progress for 20 years. And first of all, to my co-hosts, Crystalline and Andre, welcome to the show again. And we're back. We're live this week, so it's great to be back. I hope
it
you
sure
guys
is.
Had a great break. I had
it was
a great
wonderful.
Break.
It was wonderful, and it's good to be back on the Cosmic Citizen with you, Paula, and with you, Crystalline.
And I want to put in a little plug for Owen. Sorry, Crystalline, I had you on mute, darling, because your phone is crackling just a little bit. So sorry about that. Welcome back, Crystalline.
Thank you. Great to be back.
You know, you called me to do a test before we started, and it wasn't crackling, but once you called the show, it is. So I'm sorry. I don't know why it does that. But yeah, it's great to have you back and great to be back. And Larry, I know you're with us online. It's so good to have you on the show with us to talk about your wonderful work, The Chronicle of Jesus.
Well, I'm very, very pleased to be here.
Good.
Glad
and
to have
Joan
you with
had
us,
a,
Larry.
Thank
Joan
you.
Had something she had to do, but she might chime in a little later if she can.
Yeah, she was helping out a friend, and we had really short notice, so she had to, you know, fulfill that obligation.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Thanks for coming on with short notice. Sometimes, you know, it's hard to get all of this stuff done, but my hat's off to you, Crystalline, because you do a great job lining up guests. And Larry, it's so great to have you back on the show. Just to remind our visitors, Larry has been on before talking about what I believe is one of the best historical books about the Urantia book and the Urantia movement and the origins of the book, and it's the history of the Urantia teachings. What is it? It's the history of the Urantia papers, actually.
Yeah, we call
and
it A History.
A History, okay.
Yeah.
And that's available
because
at your...
there's a lot of histories out there.
Well, that's true.
There's no D
and
history.
Yours is the best, I think. It's well written.
In all modesty, I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I had Meredith helping me. I mean, you couldn't go wrong there.
No.
No, you couldn't. Yeah,
indeed.
We're all in agreement with you, too, Larry. It's the most comprehensive history that's out there, and I remember when you were putting it together, you drew from as many sources as you could. You went through the data unafraid, and you had Meredith Spunger helping both in the background and right alongside you in some respects, as I remember, and you know, with that kind of an endorsement, I don't know how you could have gone wrong. So
yeah.
I assume you didn't go wrong. You know, it's a beautiful, comprehensive history. And
oh, you know,
Merritt, I've returned to over and over again.
Yeah. Merritt Horn was, he had every edition of the Urantia book, about 12 or 15 or something back
mm-hmm.
then, which was very, very valuable. And,
mm-hmm.
and he was quite helpful, too. But there were a lot of people.
Uh-oh. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I think we had about 14 Urantians, which was like herding cats, to
yeah.
get everybody read what we put in, and whatever debates that went on. And we tried to, if we found a particular thing that someone was very strongly against, we let them say their say and put both in. We tried very hard to make it a representative of quite a few minds.
And there again is another thing that, I mean, you spent a good amount of your time on that, years and years compiling that and getting that ready for publication, and you're in your second printing now? Or
yes.
third?
Second, well, it'll be just two right now. I don't, we may revise again. I don't know. This one should last us a while, I hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, Meredith and, just casually one day mentioned to me, he said, Larry, you should write a history. Are you motivated to do that? Are you motivated to do that? You know, one casual remark like that spent 3 years trying to put it together.
Well,
but
you know,
he was in his peak right then, and we got his very best of Meredith.
You really did. Timing was just on your side right there, very much so. And we lost Meredith not that long ago. He was 95, I think.
Yeah. His son communicates with me quite a bit. And
that's good.
He's working hard with the prisons, and he has a ministry there.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, we should mention that you're actually have written many books. Is there one site like the Meta Values Breakthrough, which I also love, and Jesus, God, and Man, another fine book. And you have a website where people can go and order all of these books directly from you. And then also, I think they're all available on Amazon.com, right?
Yeah, they are. And Facebook has a pretty nice thing. If you go on Facebook and look for Larry Mullins, author, they have pretty much everything that I've written.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Well, so you just recently published this wonderful work, The Chronicle of Jesus, The Greatest Life Ever Lived. And it's such a unique effort and such a unique book. Maybe you can give us, it's written as like from a newspaper man's point of view that tells the story like as if you were the man on the scene, the reporter on the scene, at the time Jesus was alive, and you're recording the events of his whole life. Do you want to give us a bit of a history about how that came to be?
Yeah, actually what happened, originally I talked to when I worked for Clyde Bedell, I talked to a friend of mine, who was a philosopher and pretty much an agnostic and thought the Urantia book was just ridiculous. However, he was very insightful and very brilliant. And I told him that I thought USA Today, this was back 25 years ago, USA Today was a great concept, that it was like creating a newspaper for young people and with full-color illustrations and clear headlines and things like that. And he liked the idea. He thought it was a wise idea. Then later on, Mo and I were talking, and there was a book called Chronicle of World History that had...
You mean Mo Siegel, correct?
Yeah, Mo Siegel, huh? And we were talking about doing something about Jesus, and I just said, you know, maybe we could do a Chronicle of Jesus-like news stories, because I remember that conversation we had about USA Today, and he loved the idea, so that's what started it. But that was, God, 25 years ago or so. And when Joan and I got married, we've been married 22 years. But when we got married, that was the first project we worked on. At that time, as Paula was pointing out to me earlier, you couldn't really have a quote from the Urantia book very much, if you could do it at all. And so I paraphrased all these news stories, which I had a blast doing, because it was fun. I was sloppy all over the place. But, you know, and I was putting my own ideas in and things. In the course of the 20 years, when the book came in the public domain, Joan got involved and more insisted that we stick to the actual text of the Urantia book and not, you know, all my paraphrasing gradually disappeared. However, she was so right, because the philosophical points of view of the book, the slightest little nuance that you introduce in there can change the meaning. And the midwares knew exactly what they were doing, so she was totally correct in correcting all that. And the words of Jesus, the midwares knew what they were doing. And so over the years, we just completely revised it several times. and finally came up with the final product, which, as we say in the preface, we were more collectors and editors than creators and originators. Most of the text from the book, well, there's creativity in it, but most of the real important concepts are directly from the book. And I tell you the whole story here. when we started out and we'd first written it, Mo and all of us looked at it and said, well, yeah, but how are we going to print something like this? We can't get photographs. We'd never get permission to get all these photographs. And we can't use the text from the book. As all these things unfolded, it took us about 2 years to get permission with the photographs, to locate who owned the rights. It was interesting because there was a book called Jesus of Nazareth, and it had the photographs in the movie by Zeffirelli, which was one of the best movies about Jesus ever done. Zeffirelli directed it. But this book we used for the photographs for kids. We had a kids group, and I'd put in little photographs, and they'd read the little stories, and that evolved gradually into the book that finally came about. The photographs, I think, probably added tremendously because there was continuity. You didn't have a painting of Jesus here and a photograph here and this and that. You had a continuity of character and with the apostles and Jesus all the way through, and I think that really made the book credible and also kind of accessible and all those nice things.
Yeah, you know, you don't at all try to hide the fact that this is inspired by the Urantia book and by the life and teachings of Jesus from the Urantia book, which the authors of the Urantia book tell us the greatest of all human knowledge is exactly that, Jesus' life and how he lived it. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I know all of you do, too. And the thing about, you know, this story and this book, the Urantia book, and Larry, I think, you know, I've quoted you often because years ago you said, really, the whole Urantia book is about Jesus. The whole Urantia book is a book about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And past, present, and future. And they start to mention him within the first paper, I believe, or,
absolutely.
You know. And he is throughout the entire book, who he is, you know, everything about him. I mean, if you want to know about Jesus, the Urantia book is the most definitive source on the planet. I can't imagine anything anywhere would give a person a greater sense of who Jesus is. But when you read that, you just burn with this desire to share it with others. I mean, it's just so important. Well, you can imagine what it was like to have this burning desire to share it and not be able to share more than 300 words from it. That's like saying, you know, you want to see the Grand Canyon, all you get is this postcard. You'll never get any more than that.
Yeah,
and,
very true.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was daunting, and I remember those days so clearly how daunted we felt. And you know, it was one obstacle to overcome after another. You know, first you had to paraphrase, like you said, and I know at one point you got a lot of the young people in Boulder helping you with this project, and I remember seeing your original mock-ups and thinking, wow, this is so great. This will be so fantastic. You know, and then
in those days, it became a real, real toil as time went on because Joan was a perfectionist. And dates had to be checked, and names had checked, and she had to see it in writing, or you didn't get it into the book. I mean, she was tough, but thank God for her because it would have been so much less if she hadn't contributed.
Mm.
Oh well, she and we all know Joan, so you know it makes us chuckle because she is pays such attention to detail, and she has the focus of a laser beam. such a darling person, too. You know, you're a lucky man, Larry Mullins.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, too, that we had two objectives. We wanted to reach the Urantia youth, which I think, when I say youth, I mean young people, but not children. But we should do a version for very young people. We are going to do a coloring book. But,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. My daughter's working on that. But the youth has been neglected by the Urantia movement, I think. In fact, Mo told me a story once to his little boy. I forget his name. Was it? You remember?
Lucas.
Lucas. When he got his first book, he was only 8 years old. So he put on a tie and shirt, and he came down and sat in the chair with his book. And was trying to read it. It's just they were so hungry. And when I mentioned to Michelle that Joan and I were going to start this study group for young people, she said, "At last." It was really, really got me. I said, "Boy, these young people are hungry to know this stuff, and they want tools and all that."
Well,
but
it's interesting that you bring this up, Larry, because Paula and I were just talking about the show that we plan to do the week following your series here is on that topic.
Right? Oh, and the young people?
Why do we hold back?
Yeah, absolutely. And I heard your ranchers way back say, I don't want to influence them and stuff like that, which is absurd.
Yeah, I think you're right, Larry. I mean, it's been, on the face of it, it seems like a reasonable attitude, and yet, every religion that has, been promulgated, and granted, the Urantia book is not a religion, but still, the truths that we want to get across about the life and teachings of Jesus profoundly affect our religious life.
Absolutely.
So how would we not want to be motivating and challenging and fostering the religious growth of our youth by presenting them with that inspiring example and of Jesus that's given in the Urantia book? Let them make up their own mind, but not in a vacuum, is the approach that I took with my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they've made up their own minds, and they're going forward in their own way, and I have no doubt that eventually they'll come around, more and more to the teachings of the Urantia book. But I've got two wonderful emergent Christian daughters. They've decided that's the way they're going forward with their religious leanings, and that is, of course, very very true to the spirit of Jesus' teachings, the new emergent Christian movement. But the idea is, I'm not trying to talk about my kids so much as to say that I've seen the results of readers that had that as part of their a parental philosophy, and many of their children grew up with really no interest in the book at all.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, and one of the things that I'd like to reiterate again is that, when your kids are young and they are really interested in your opinions about the world and about life, mm-hmm. And you miss out on the opportunity at that stage in their life to share the truths from the fifth epical revelation. You're not only missing an amazing opportunity for bonding and for increased intimacy within the family, but you're missing a really vital tool for teaching values and problem solving and emotional stability. And one of the things that I see when I look around at young people who have grown up with this amazing book or these amazing teachings as a vital part of their teaching, you know, youthful teaching experience, they have a sense of self-confidence and stability that is not really that common these days.
That's very true. Actually, you know, what you're talking about right now, one of the things I always wanted was a tool, rather than hand Michelle a Urantia book, to hand her the Chronicle when she was young and get her a visual that would grab her imagination far greater than a forbidding thick book. And so it could be used as a tool to evangelize your youth, as well as outside of the mainstream. That's another thing I did want to say. The other goal, aside from youth, was the mainstream.
Yes.
And that one, the jury's still out on that. I have a feeling that we are going to penetrate the mainstream because, you know, Urantians have been talking to each other for, we've been trembling on the brink of a great new epic for a long, long time now, 50, 60 years. So we need to get into the mainstream fearlessly the way...
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Just exactly the way Peter raged out and converted 2,000 people by lifting Jesus up. I'm not sure, and believe me, this Chronicle is only a path to the true book, but we wanted to make it a wholesome, exciting, and interesting path. I'm encouraged because I want to read you a little paragraph by this philosopher friend of mine. He wrote a review about the book. What he nailed, and he is not a reader, he is maybe a sort of believer, I don't know, but he said, while the Chronicles is an easy read, it is by no means a lightweight work. The levels of ideas and research that went into this book are truly awe-inspiring. But I should add here, the research was done by the Midware. What we read here is not just a biblical scholar writing about the Bible, or a historian writing about history, or a sociologist writing about the people of that period, or even a philosopher showing Jesus' teachings from a philosophical point of view. No, what you have here is a book that is all these things and more. That is why the work is awe-inspiring and a true creative tour de force. That, though, is really a compliment to the Urantia book, not to the Chronicle, because of Urantia book, he couldn't have described it better.
Indeed. Isn't that so true? I mean, and, you know, here you have this, it's just the perfect material to do what you've done with it. And I love the way that you've played in the book with headlines.
Yeah, he loved it.
And just, I want to just kind of go to the very beginning where you say, Mesopotamian Sikh baby, Jerusalem, 7 BC. Several Chaldean priests are reportedly on a strange mission in Jerusalem. Their leader, Ardnan, declared yesterday that they were looking for the light of life, a child who is to be born here among the Jews. One of the priests referred to a teacher in Ur, who disclosed a vivid dream he had about this prophecy. Some speculate that the rumored birth could be that of the Messiah, the legendary deliverer of Israel. The priest left for Bethlehem today, possibly on the advice of a high official at the temple here. A spokesman for King Herod cautioned that speculation about a new king was not in the interest of Israel. I just love it. That's the article. And you know, so then it goes on to the next article, controversial Messiah poem text released, and then executions of children rumored. So it just tells the story in this, just these beautiful, short but succinct articles, and it really is. It's like 235 pages approximately, and 240, okay. And it just takes you through the story with these great pictures. I mean, in, you know, the Zeffirelli pictures, that was a real coup to get those pictures,
wasn't
Larry.
My hat, the angels totally helped us on that for sure.
How many years did it take you to get those rights?
Two years of negotiation. They first just blew me out of the water. They said that what they wanted was impossible. And as it gradually unfolded, they couldn't come up with the original photographs on everything. Excuse me. And so what happened was, excuse me, I got to clear my throat here just a minute.
Oh, no problem.
What happened after that was we had to scan. Now, Eric Kosh scanned all the photographs in the book, and they supplemented these with some digital photographs. So it ended up that we were able to kind of bargain them down to where we could somehow afford it. We really couldn't afford it, but we did. And that we were so happy to get those photographs. We knew that would make or break the whole thing.
Well, I remember, you know, and again, we're talking about how daunting it was at the time to try and undertake this kind of a project, only being able to use 300 words from the book, and knowing that you wouldn't get permission to use any more from the Urantia book, any more words from the Urantia book, and try to do this whole story without breaking copyright. But then the other daunting part was images. And I know, because I worked with Jesus Onan and with Mo Siegel for so many years, that many Christian artists are not even going to give you a second glance if you approach them about using their artwork for something like this. And so, you know, I mean, we just felt blessed if an artist was willing to let us use their images. It was just a celebration, just one image, let alone, say, the hundreds of images you have in here. And to get these Zeccarelli images.
Over 350.
And they're consistent. That's what's so nice. I mean, it allows the person, the reader, to follow through, and it's the same characters as you go on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing about artists inspired by the life of Jesus, they all paint him looking differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so were you to use that, it would have looked very eclectic, even if you could have gone.
Oh, yeah, that's very typical. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But with
one
this,
moment of
it's
truth,
consistent.
Too, was with Mo. Mo and I have had our differences over the years, big time. I decided I was going to call Mo and ask him if I could use some of his art out of the blue, and he was a prince about it. He was so generous and so fair about it, and cooperated fully with everything we needed. We needed artwork because once the photographs ended in the book, there were no real pictures of Jesus' appearances, but Mo had a lot of those, and that's what we acquired from him. He let us use them without a charge or anything, and cooperated fully, and that was a big, big help, too.
Oh,
that's remarkable.
Amazing. And, you know, just going through, I mean, I'm a person who, I love images, and I've been criticized for that. I don't look at religious art in the same way that, you know, I mean, I look at religious art from the point of view of saying, what was the artist thinking when he painted that? What was the emotion that he was trying to capture, the love of Christ that he had in his heart, that he held in his heart when he undertook painting an image of someone so important to him, someone nobody's ever seen? You know, and I always envision that he was inspired in his heart to create this image of Jesus, to show Jesus's compassion or to show Jesus's, you know, strength or whatever it is, whatever the quality of Jesus the artist was trying to capture. And that's for all religious art for me. I always try to look at it from the point of view of the artist and not in any superficial way. Gee, what's the color of his skin? Or did people of that time really wear their hair that way? Or, you know, I really don't look at that at all. But I appreciate and the work that Mo has done in creating this artwork, you know, because it a lot of it tells stories, like you said, that aren't in the Bible. They're in the Urantia book, but they're not in the Bible. So, it's really nice that you were able to use those and incorporate those. And as I've gone through and looked at these pictures, what I've seen is that they really do complement the Zeffirelli pictures that you have. It doesn't look like a different Jesus, really. So,
well,
it's kind of neat.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it was kind of a moment of truth with me when I said, you know, I got to have some photographs or some illustrations of after the transfiguration, after Jesus was translated into another form. And I don't have anything, and I'll have to call Mo. Getting my nerve up to call Mo and ask him. I was really intimidated, but he was gracious. He was a prince about it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know whether you want to go into why it would take you, you know, getting your nerve up for any of that. But you know, it was, I'm aware of some of that history, and I agree with you that's, I mean, what it's illustrative of is, you know, when there's a really important project and a high aim to be achieved, how wonderful it is that our thought adjusters and our angels help us to do the right thing and find harmony where greater good can come out of it.
Very true.
And so my hat's off to you for doing that, because that's quite a coup. That's quite a wonderful thing to have enlisted Mo's cooperation on this wonderful work that you've done. And you're bringing up... It brought some things to mind, the fact that we've talked about that this has been more than 20 years in the making. And I remember when, you know, we would talk, because you and I and a number of other people, we used to meet on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. But we would hear about... The young person study group that you had, and I'm curious as to how you vetted this work, how you might have either been inspired to do this work, but also did you get a chance to, while this was a work in progress, actually do field research by presenting it to the young people's group, or was it something that the young people's group was more of an inspiration for the work?
Yeah, I would say the latter, because the young people kind of got, we didn't have all the stuff together, and once the young people reached a certain age, it was almost like they were, why Michelle said at last, when we decided to start an actual study group, and what we had, Michelle was about 14, and the Thurston children were... it was Jesse Thurston, and I think he was a little older. Angie was a little younger, and Haley was, I think, about 9. And
mm-hmm.
Haley was not interested in, she wanted to do something else. She wasn't interested. After about 6 months or so, she joined the group. And we'd have pizza afterward. They would read from the book. These were very bright kids. They're very exceptional children.
Mm-hmm.
And they would read from the book. And after we completed the whole reading the whole book, it took us about almost 6 years. And they all got a copy, a leather-bound copy with their name on it, once they finished. And they wanted to start again. They were grown. Most of them, Michelle was out of college by then almost. But... they were so excited about this, and they were Urantians. They weren't Catholics that were Urantians. They weren't Lutherans. They were Urantians, and they didn't even blink an eye to say they were a Urantian. So it was very gratifying to see that happen.
And what did you see that meaning to them when they would refer to themselves as Urantians? How did you interpret that?
I interpreted it that I was behind the times, because... they didn't even think twice about it. I back in the old days, you know, we would say, well, my religion is I'm a Catholic, but I'm also read the Urantia book. Instead of being a believer, a Urantia believer, now these kids just accepted that they were Urantians believers, and that was it. And I was just said, gee, Larry, you're an old fogey here. These kids are way ahead of you.
Well, having been one of those myself, I can say that, you know, really the difference is that when you start out with something in your life, you know, early on in your life, that you don't have the same kinds of conflicts. One of the differences in growing up with this revelation is that you don't have a lot of other stuff to undo or to, you know, sort of toss out and replace. This is our foundational philosophy. And so there's not nearly as much conflict as first generation leaders probably.
Huh?
Pardon me?
Yeah, I was fortunate to be one of the unchurched. I had never went to church when I was a kid. No, there was never even mentioned. I was Catholic, but we never went to church. So I just picked up things as I went along. And when I met Clyde Bedell, gosh, I was 33 years old, and he handed me a Urantia book. I thought, oh, brother, just another one of these interesting channeled books or whatever. And it took me several years before I finally caught on, and the book kind of captured me. But I didn't have any religion, so it was like I was a blank slate.
Isn't that amazing?
I think I was an advantage to be unchurched.
Yes. I agree.
You go through this conflict of is this right or is that right? Did Mary really ascend to heaven physically? Or, you know, it is a tremendous conflict that goes on.
Well, I had the experience of being both churched and Urantian at the same time, and side by side from the very beginning.
Mm.
And for my parents, it wasn't a conflict because they felt like it was really important for us to have an experience of what our peers would be experiencing, to have some kind of an acculturalization into where all of our peers would be,
mm-hmm.
right alongside the experience of the fifth epical revelation. And that was pretty easy for us. I mean, one of the things that I remember my dad saying was that this isn't something that everybody else you're going to run into is going to know about. So be respectful of that,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
to not try to impose our ideas or our experience with this onto our peers before they were old enough to make those kinds of choices for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, that's about the only thing he said about it. But it was something that we felt reverently about, that this was not something we wanted to, like, we weren't encouraged to mess with other people's family traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all personal experience, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It is,
you know.
Personal experience.
By the time I got into college, I remember feeling like that admonition was over. You know, like all bets were off. By the time we were college age, I felt like it was, you know, perfectly acceptable. Plus, I was studying comparative religion. And so a lot of the other students I was with were interested in these issues.
Mm.
And you are free to talk about them at that point. You know, I note that my daughter has expressed to me, and she's 17 and a half, and she's just started her senior year in high school, that her friends come from all different religious backgrounds. Mormon and Catholic and you know, even Muslim. And they don't talk about religion. It's almost like an unspoken agreement with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll share, like when one of them has a milestone within their church and some kind of celebration or, you know, ceremony or whatever, they'll share that and they'll celebrate that together, but they don't really talk about, well, you believe this, well, I believe that, and, you know, they don't get into those kinds of arguments. It's almost like not relevant to them. You know, it just,
very,
you know,
very true.
Who, mm-hmm. And I think that's progressive. I really do. I think it's progressive that that they don't hold that against each other. or even,
you know, Maslow, you know, one of the things he said, you know, in the Meta Values Breakthrough, that book, one of the things he observed was, he said, you know, I can talk to people about sex or anything, and they're very open and free, but once I start talking about their inner life or their religious feelings or their peak experiences or any unusual experience they may have had, or did you ever have an angel experience or anything like that, they get freeze up and just close up completely.
Wow. That's interesting.
Where was he doing his research?
Well, he researched, you know, Maslow, his work, everybody knows the pyramid, and the interesting thing about his pyramid is that where he left off at self-actualizing is where Jesus picked up. That whole book is based on the five principles of the kingdom of heaven, and I kind of developed a pyramid, an inverse pyramid, after self-actualization. What's the spiritual progress? It's all in the kingdom of heaven paper. In about one paragraph, the whole book was based on one paragraph in that kingdom of heaven paper. Urantians, you'll ask a Urantian, do you believe in the kingdom of heaven? Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. I used to have fun in giving a talk. I'd say, everybody believe in the kingdom of heaven? Oh, yeah, you're right, yeah, yeah. Oh, good, okay. Tell me the first principle and I'll write it on the board here. Silence.
Mm-hmm.
Total silence. The preeminence of the individual. Oh, okay. What's the second principle? The will is the deciding factor in human experience. Those two things are the two things that bridge you into the self-actualization process. And Jesus knew that. And Jesus said that the third thing, when he summarized the kingdom, was partnership with God. We all want that. We all want partnership with God. But the interesting thing is, unless we've forgiven everyone, unless we hold no resentments, we cannot accept forgiveness from God. God mm-hmm. will forgive us, of course, but we can't receive that until we forgive. So the preeminence of the individual is self-respect as well as respect for others, which means respecting the fact they made a mistake or whatever and forgiving them for it. And then the second principle makes no sense at all when you say the will, the human will, is a determining factor in human experience. Well, what does that mean? It means that the inner life is dependent on a human will. The quality of the inner life is predicated on the human will itself, our attitude towards circumstances. We create the inner life ourselves. No one can create it for us. But those things to me are just fabulously interesting, and, you know, I guess I enjoy it more than anybody.
I love your book on the Meta Values Breakthrough book. I thoroughly enjoyed that book. And I would love to just digress a little bit and have you give us a definition of what self-actualization is.
Yeah, again, Maslow got to the very point of self-actualizing. He observed that. Now, this is pretty extraordinary when you think, he said that 1% approximately of human beings actually enter into this process, that they people tend not to want to forgive resentments. They tend not to want to take responsibility for the inner life, and you know, they want to blame circumstances outside of themselves. But he said that 1% of the people that he studied were unusual. They were different. They were different types of people. And the main difference was they didn't have shame. They didn't have guilt. They weren't burdened by all this baggage of their past. They were kind of washed clean of that. That particular factor is where self-actualizing starts, where we can enter into partnership with God. Every single self-actualizer that Maslow studied was devoted to a cause greater than themselves. Every one of them also were devoted to truth, beauty, and goodness. He actually used those words. And when you say, oh, that means that somewhere intrinsic in human nature are these values. Of course, because it's a thought adjuster's inside. Truth, beauty, and goodness is inside of us. So that starts to manifest as they get past this, these blocks of resentment and blocks of not taking responsibility, blocks of, you know, all the immature blocks we have. That's where Jesus picked up with the partnership with God. And, of course, Maslow, being a scientist, couldn't bring God into the equation, unfortunately, but Jesus did. And it, once partnership with God kicks in, that's the third principle. The fourth principle is the great joy of service. And that's when we get into a higher and higher level of serving humankind, and where the profit motive gives way to the service motive more and more. And I think that's happening now in business. And then finally, transcendence. The personality is pure, and it's the platform we stand on. While all the other world goes crazy around us, we can stand on that platform of personality, which is a reality, a stationary part in the universe, where we can stand. And if we step into that eye of the hurricane, we can breathe easy and feel God. And we don't have to be captured by the nonsense going around us.
We're safe. We're really safe from the vicissitudes.
Yeah.
In the world, but not of it.
That's right.
As Jesus said.
But
I
became fascinated by Maslow when I lost my daughter years and years ago, and wanted to figure out what had happened. But I also started reading the Ranch book, and truly trying to read it at that same point, because none of the mystic things, none of the reincarnation or any of that stuff worked. I just had to find a way of figuring out that Vicki was okay, and someday I'd get to sit down with her and ask what she'd learned over the years. And I really had to believe that she survived her experience of death. And because the Ranch book gave me that, I read it a couple times in a few, but within 6 months I'd read the book twice and became convinced that it was valid.
How
I've never found anything.
How old was she, Larry, when that
13
happened?
Yes, died of sniffing paint.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that of all my life, I've been through things like everybody else, but losing a child's a 10, everything else a 5, divorce and everything else a 5,
right.
Nothing gets close. Now, a woman, I can imagine, is even 10 times more painful than for a man, for a mother.
Well, I think there's probably some truth to that, because we are the earthly life carriers, and you know, it's something so magical about carrying that life inside of you and suffering to bring it upon the earth and nurturing it so tenderly, and every moment you give, and not to diminish what fathers give for their children, because they do it all so volitionally, and it's really amazing and wonderful, and I adored my father, and I wouldn't trade that relationship for anything on earth. But I think you're right that mothers feel very intrinsically connected from the moment, from the first moment that they feel life inside of them, and every day after that, if they're normal. You know, I know that not all mothers are devoted to their children, but I think naturally most mothers are.
I've seen some fathers who are, you know, sort of equally devoted.
Yeah, I have too. And I agree with you. I can't imagine anything worse than that. And to think that the Urantia book helps people overcome a loss so great, and I've heard this story over and over and over again, that it does, that it helps people overcome losses that are just tremendous. And we know that faith does that too. The Bible does that. Christianity does that. I mean, people who have a deep and strong abiding faith can endure so much more than those who have nothing, you know, to fall back on. No foundation.
Larry, can you share a little, some of the details of how you struggled and how your growing relationship with the book, and the teachings and your growing faith walk at that time did help you through that experience?
Well, you know, as I said, after I read the book, I met Berkeley Elliott and I ended up writing Jesus, God, and Man, but 12 years would go by of where I still nursed this hatred of the hospital that where Vicky died, and the hatred of the people that let her sniff inside the hospital. I couldn't get over that, but I was sort of going through the motions of being a Goodyear Ranchian and giving talks and writing Jesus, God, and Man and things like that. But there was still this poisonous thing inside of me that I didn't really realize. And then when I got a second divorce, I got married too soon after my first wife died. And after 12 years, I got a second divorce. I went into a 12-step program and became really excited about the spiritual part of it and got into it and really into it on and on. And they have a fifth step in the 12-step program and where you confess your resentments and hatreds and all these things that you carry and things. I was in Oklahoma City at the time. I'd moved from Tulsa where Vicky died. I asked if I could get somebody. I didn't want anybody that knew me. And they looked around. They found a fifth-step black belt that could talk to me in Tulsa, so I had to go back to Tulsa. And driving into Tulsa that day, I went by the hospital, and it's a huge, huge pink building. And I thought that's the same thing I thought every time I passed it when I lived in Tulsa. That's where they killed Vicky, and I just felt this pain and hatred again. It was interesting that I met this guy that was going to help me with the 12-step. He took me to his house, and we sat there and had a cup of coffee. And I said, look, I'm going to tell you something. I've got a resentment that even God can't fix, and I want to tell you about it. And I told him about Vicky dying in the hospital and we losing the case to these great lawyers that the hospital had and costing me a fortune and
Losing the case of suing the hospital?
Well, we sued because Vicky died in the hospital. We sued for malpractice, and they had...
Well, you said she was actually sniffing paint or huffing paint in the hospital, right?
Actually, it was deodorant there. That's all they could find. It's her and this girl. But they both were in there for the same reason. They had the greatest lawyers, I mean, real killer lawyers that wiped us out, and and then my wife died shortly after, got cancer shortly after and died.
Oh, stress.
So I was filled with real hatred, and I explained all this to this guy that for this step, and he
was
just
he
turned
like a
white
sponsor?
As a sheet.
Was he like your sponsor?
No, because sometimes a fifth-step guy is, you have to get somebody that is experienced and knows how to handle some of the most terrible things. You know, I wasn't anything like some of these poor people, but I did have that hatred. And so when I told the guy the story, he turned white as a sheet. And when I remember thinking, well, this guy's supposed to be tough. Okay, this isn't that bad. And he said, you know, Larry, there's only one place you should be today, and that's here with me. And there's only one person you should be talking to, and that's me. I said, why? He said, because I was one of the doctors that tried to save Vicky's life that night. I was on what they call a code blue, yeah. I was on a code blue team, and I held her in my arms. He said, I thought we had saved her. and she got her heart went into fibrillations, and we just lost her. He said she died in my arms.
Mm.
And I've always, he said, I didn't recognize your name. I didn't realize that it was you. He said, I read about in the paper, and I read about the lawsuit. I read about all that. He said, and I always wanted to tell you, look, we tried. We tried so hard to save her life. And we didn't. We weren't able to do that. So, I didn't know what to say. I was totally stunned. And we held hands afterward. I don't know how long. We didn't say another word.
Mm.
And when I left, he kept in contact for years afterward. And he told me this changed his life as well as mine.
Mm.
When I left, I didn't exactly know what had happened. But when I went by the hospital, the sun kind of turns everything gilded and gold?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When it's just when
I went
it's
by
setting.
The hospital, drove by the hospital, and what I thought was this, that's where they tried to save Vicky's life that night.
Mm.
And
wow.
I didn't hear
a
voice,
shift.
But I felt this in my mind, or somewhere within me, it was like his voice said, son, don't try to tell me what I can do and can't do. And
mm-hmm.
after that, I think I really had a turnaround, a complete turnaround. When I told this story at the Snowmass, Joan had got me to speak there, and I met Joan. I'd been divorced by then. That was like a whole new life for me.
Yeah, I remember that moment in Snowmass. There was not a dry eye in the house.
No,
it was really
well, there
quiet.
Isn't a dry eye here for me. I mean, that to me, that's you can attribute that to so many things. But I mean, if that's not a demonstration of the power of God generally, the power of taking faith steps oneself. The power of the social architects to arrange a situation that seems impossible and that can move mountains of faith. I don't know what is. And that story is always, for me, Larry, that's signal. That is the penultimate story for me on the power of God and our angels to turn things around for us,
and
I always
really,
appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
And
thank
really
you.
What is meant by a transformative experience or a transformational experience. There have been people that I've talked with over the years who have said, well, I don't understand really what you mean when you ask me, you know, have I ever had any kind of a transformative or transformational experience? And frankly, I've shared your story with people on that topic because I think it's just so vividly illustrative of what that really means, what
mm-hmm.
that might feel like.
Mm-hmm.
A classic paradigm shift to drive by at one moment earlier in the day and say, this is the place that killed my baby. To later on, after that revelation of meeting the actual person that held her in his arms and tried to save her life, to say this is the place that tried to save my baby's life, you know, it's just truly transformational. And to me, it's how God works. You know, in my experience, when we reach out, and let's say when we reach in to the inner life, and we say a prayer, and we set our intention, and we say, Father, I want to overcome, I want to forgive, I want to get beyond, help me with this, I need comfort, I need something, Father, help me, then it's always a human who also has God in him, you know, because we all do. And that's how God answers my prayers. He sends me a human who listens, who cares, who is, you know, it's that the five stages you just gave us, who is into the joy of service, which I know to be ministry. And that person helps me. And I know it's how God works. And it's how the angels work. The angels are masters at bringing people together at just the right
just
moment
the right
in time.
Time.
Yeah. And every time it happens, no matter how many times it happens to me, I am blown away. I celebrate in my heart. I'm like, you guys are so good at this.
I'm awed.
I'm in awe of you. Yeah, absolutely. And so I love that story. And you know, here you are. You met Joan. You really got to know Joan when you guys worked together on Snowmass, and Joan was indispensable at that conference. She was working for John Hay at the time, and I'm sure John would say she's the best assistant he ever had in his life.
I'm sure he would.
And she worked so hard on that conference, and you guys got married in what, 93,
92? 92,
91,
I think.
91, okay. And so you've spent the better part of your life working on the Chronicles, the Chronicle of Jesus.
Isn't that amazing?
And, yeah. The better part of
no,
your life together,
story.
You two.
It's kind of interesting. There's a story in the Apocrypha I didn't put in the history that I couldn't verify, but I really believe it's true that one of the contact commissioners asked the midwives, when did they start working on the Revelation? And they were told around 1200.
Wow.
And then someone said, well, what took you so long? And there was a long pause, and then the voice said, well, we understand that you think that's a long time.
Yeah.
To you, it probably seems like a long time, but for us, it was probably pretty reasonably, you know, just
it was just
being
starting
thorough.
A project and seeing it through.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine they probably said, what's taking this guy so long to do this?
Well, you know, if one day on paradise is 1,000 years of our time, then it was just 2 days ago that Jesus was here. And,
that's right.
You know, it that perspective for me is invaluable, because we do get caught up in our own time. But I like to think of a little child, you know, a 2-year-old, 1 year is half their life. But we've been around the sun a lot more times now. So it's all relative to us. And if you've lived for 1,000,000,000 years, you know, I'm sure that 300 or 400 years didn't seem like a whole lot. Maybe just a couple of hours from our point of view.
Don't you kind of think, too, that this is the most exciting part of this whole process, is where we are right now?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, and you point out something that specifically is that exciting part, and that is that we're on the front end of so many experiences that we don't understand where it's going or how it's developing exactly. And one thing that ought not to be lost on people in the telling of that story was that in going through that experience and getting to that culminating moment, you had been doing what many people regard to be as a kind of spiritual work, you know, facing yourself and trying to get over something that you saw as a drag on your life. And by that I mean the resentments and the hatred and everything you were going through. And correct me if I'm wrong, Larry, isn't there some slogan that says, don't quit before the miracle happens?
There's so many like that. That was one of the fun things about creating the Metavalues Breakthroughs, trying to address exactly what you're talking about is, and I guess we talk to someone every week that is saying, you know, I'll never get this right. I'll never be anything. I always quit before it's the time. I can't do it. And there's no real help you can give because there's no path that these people have to walk their own path that is brand new snow, and they have to figure out how to do it. But there's a lot of help you can give. We always call it the will to fail. Maslow called it the Jonah complex.
Love that.
Yeah, we try to escape our destiny. We like Jonah. We try to get on a boat and get away from God
from
wanted
life.
To go to Nevaeh and save everybody and said, "What the hell is that? They'll kill me." He gets on a boat the story goes, you know, on and on. And he finally has to go back and accomplish it. We are all, I believe, every one of us has locked inside of us an enormous gift that we just haven't learned to unwrap yet. And when we learn to unwrap it, everything changes.
Well, that's very, very important. And nobody, I mean, the biggest problem in my view, and you've heard me talk about this through the years, is trying to find essentially the keys to the lock, find the lock, know which direction you're walking in, whatever it is. I mean, you have walked this walk. So what I'm wondering is, what can you tell people about, you know, some of the ways that you actually get to the place where you find the door, you see the lock, and you find the key to the lock, and you put the key in and turn it. What happened for you in that regard that allowed you to find yourself? And
I'll
find the God.
It happens by degrees. Joan and I just discovered this, we call the infallible mantra from the Urantia book. It's absolutely infallible. And we try to teach it to people and talk about it. And it comes very early in the book, so it's from headquarters. It's from the highest wisdom in the universe. And it's you have to study every single word to really understand it. And we say it all the time. And it says the consciousness of a victorious human life on earth is born of that creature faith that dares to confront each recurring episode of existence when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives within me someone who can and will do it, a part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And this is the victory that overcomes the world, even your faith. Boy, I'll tell you, that one is so awesome. It's so much wisdom in it. You could write a book about it. It's so magnificent.
Can you say it again?
It's one of my very, very, very favorites. Yes, say it again. Read it again.
Okay.
Read it again and again.
Please, Daddy, read it again. Read it again.
Okay, Elvis. Okay. The consciousness, this is so powerful, the consciousness of a victorious human life on earth is born of that creature faith that dares to confront each recurring episode of existence when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives within me someone who can and will do it, a part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And this is the declaration that overcomes the world, even your faith.
So beautiful. Indeed.
You know, and how many times I've read that without even getting it, and then one day it just suddenly said, oh, this is my next mantra. This is something that will help me right now. And I'll tell you, it does. It does so much. In fact, I said it before this broadcast.
Well, you know, there are a number of themes we could talk about where that took you. I mean, clearly it was a signal going through the eye of a needle moment. You meeting with that doctor in the course of a fifth step. after that, there were a number of things that happened, and a number of choices that you had to make. Can you describe that for us? You know, both in terms of, I mean, you mentioned one was the fact that you had the opportunity to choose a life partner.
Oh yeah, that was a wonderful gift.
How did that unfold for you? And what were the choices involved for you?
It was like I was just fortunate enough to be on a path that they just said, oh God, this guy's so screwed up. We've got to just lead him by the nose, or he'll never get out of it. And I really believe that that was true.
I relate, Larry. I relate.
I do too.
But there's another saying, you know, before enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water.
Right.
After enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water.
Carrying water.
So
that's good.
True.
It is so true. It's like the Arantia book saying, you know, you start over there right where you leave off down here. You know, mm-hmm. death adds nothing to you except the knowledge that you survived it. And that, I suppose, is a very powerful thing to wake up and realize that you still are. You still exist in another place, in another way, but you still are you, and you still exist. And that has to be powerful, but you still have work to do.
You also have not escaped any of your problems.
Right. There's work to do, work to be done, and the inner life doesn't have to be a chore. It can be a beautiful thing if you approach it with a light heart. And I think, you know, Larry, you were talking about being able to let go of your resentments, and that's just as important, to be able to forgive yourself, I think. And, you know, because oftentimes I think, you know, I think of Jesus saying, tell my apostles and Peter, you know, because
yeah.
he knew that Peter was beating himself up really bad. This was after his resurrection, and in one of his appearances, I think he told Mary Magdalene, go and tell my apostles and Peter. And that little and Peter, you know, was important because Peter was really in the process of beating himself up and for denying the master. And I think we tend to be sometimes our own worst enemies there. We have so much regret about some of the mistakes we've made.
Well,
yeah,
and you
so
said
true.
You said earlier that I think is so important, you know, the you know, permission to make mistakes, or the ability to handle failure is
right.
really a critical element in this whole process, because we couldn't learn experientially without making mistakes. It's really kind of a requirement for us to be able to graciously fail, or to be able to fail, and if we can't learn from them, if we're so intimidated by the very thought of making a mistake, it makes it far more difficult to evaluate it with a, you know, with a calm and detached mind.
Very true.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
Well, you know, this is just, and I want to touch on the fact that, you know, you also said, in we're talking about our own lifetimes, and it's relative to who we are. I mean, we have, my husband Glenn calls it the 100-year plan on this most difficult world, and it's very easy for us to give up. I think that's probably, of all the things, of all the mistakes we, humanity makes, it's that. We give up on ourselves. We give up on each other.
Too soon.
And I'm, too soon. We you know, we're, I'm reminded of one of my favorite lessons from God Calling, another book that I love dearly and that I read every day, and it brings me into the presence of Jesus, and it's so meaningful to me. And in one of the lessons, he talks about the race, and he says, you know, in the annals of heaven, how sad the stories of those who ran the race, you know, with good, strong hearts,
only to fall out, on the final lap, when all they needed to do was to call out to me for their final spurt. And, you know, they didn't know how near they were the end. And in my experience, and it's something you said, Andre, you said, don't give up before the miracle happens. It's true. Oftentimes, you know, we're almost there. Somebody told me once, you know, if you have water down 100 feet and you only dig 99, will you get to the water? No. You have to dig the last foot to get to the water. It's down 100 feet. It's not down 99. And we quit because it's like, oh, I've dug 99 feet and there's still no water. Oh, but just one more foot.
There must not be any water there.
Right.
Yeah.
There must not be any water there.
Yeah.
And you know, that's you know, what he says in God Calling, he says in the Annals of Heaven, so often, it's so sad when all of the hosts of heaven, he says, wanted to call out, no, don't stop.
Don't stop yet.
My favorite story about that is that one about the A.J. Cronin. He wrote Keys to the Kingdom, and how he wrote his first book. He was a doctor, and he had a bleeding ulcer. He's about 30 years old. He hated being a doctor, and he had his ulcer burst and almost died, and they put him on 6 months. He had to live on this island, completely separated from civilization, practically. In just a very small part of Scotland. And he sat there for a couple of days, and he said, God, I'm going to write a book. I always wanted to write a book. So he goes in and gets notebooks and starts writing and writing and writing, and sending these written things to a secretary who would type them and send them back. And he got almost, this is where the Jonah complex came in. He gets pretty far along in the book, and then he realizes, he said, I'm not capable of this. This is stupid. This book is horrible. And he starts reading it and says, this is terrible. No one will read this. So he says, I give up. So he takes the book and he dumps it in the trash can. And it was raining. And he puts on his jacket and he says, I'm going to walk in the rain, just get rid of this idea. And he walks along and he sees this guy digging in the field, the old Angus, he called him. And he watches him a while, and Angus says, how's your book coming? He said, I realize that I'm not really capable of writing a book. And I just put it away. It's just can't do it. And he said, Angus looked at him with this sort of contemptuous look, and he said, you know, you're probably right, and I'm probably wrong, but my father ditched this bog all his days trying to make a meadow, and he never did, and I ditched it all my days, and middle or no middle, I cannot help but dig. And maybe it's the same with your wee book. And he started digging again. Cronin was just furious. It just embarrassed him so much. So he walks back to the house, and he fishes this manuscript out of the soaking wet, out of the garbage can. He dries it in the oven, and he decides, by God, I'll finish this thing. And he goes ahead and finishes it, and when it's all finished and typed, he picks a publisher by sticking a pin, closing his eyes and sticking a pin in the directory, mails it off. They accept the book. He gets a telegram just before he's finished his 6 months, and they said they accepted it. And he went to this old Angus and said, look at this telegram. And Angus said, huh, yeah, and that was it. Well, the book became, they're called Hatter's Castle. That was his first book. It was translated into 21 languages. Completely changed his life. They made a movie of it. And this was, if he had not run into old Angus, that's when the angels directed his steps, like they've helped so many people, and interrupted his desire to quit and made him finish it. To me, that was the greatest example of the Jonah complex being triumphed over.
It reminds me of the story of Bucky Fuller sitting on the banks of Lake Michigan contemplating suicide.
Absolutely, absolutely.
When
that's another great one.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, a lot of people don't know, he was an alcoholic when he was young. And he was devoted to, actually, he figured he would be dead pretty soon because he was 30. And the life expectancy for people born at the turn of the century was about 35 to 40. He didn't think he'd live much longer, and he was drinking too much, and his daughter had died, and he just was totally discouraged. He was going to jump in the lake and kill himself. And he heard this voice or a feeling of a voice that said, "You have no right to destroy yourself. You do not belong to yourself. You belong to the universe."
Mm-hmm.
And he paused and thought, and then it said, "You'll never know." This voice kind of said, "You'll never know your significance, but you can be sure that you will live up to your highest potential if every time you have a intercourse with an individual, psychological intercourse, conversation, you try to turn it to their good and not your own, then you'll know you're doing your highest level of service." Well, he said he stuck to that all his life. He lived to be 95.
Wow.
And completely had a, he said he gave up worrying about making a living, and he just tried to do that one mantra to make it right for the other person, and it completely changed his life.
And look at how many lives he touched.
Oh yeah.
From that point on, so many. I mean, it reminds me of another person that I really enjoy hearing speak. His name is Daniel Brinkley, and he had an experience, a near-death experience, and he says in his speeches, before my near-death experience, I used to think that real power on earth was making other people squirm and making them feel bad, so that, you know, I could take the upper hand and really lord it over them. And he said, when I died, the first time I had a panoramic life review, that's what he calls it, and he said what the angels who showed me my life review revealed to me was how it felt to be the recipient of my bullying, how I had made others feel. I was made to feel exactly that way. And it was such a shock to me how bad I made them feel. And he said when he came back, he spent the rest of his life since then showing people his love. And he said, and he concludes that real power is love. And that's what impresses them. And he actually had another near-death experience where he had another panoramic life review. And he said this time they showed him how his love made people feel.
Oh,
and how being the recipient of his love and service had made them feel.
Mm-hmm.
And he concludes that what impresses them up there, and he points up, he says what impresses them up there is love. And it just reminds me of Jesus saying, you know, he among you who would be truly great, he will be the one to serve the others. And service is love, loving service. And, you know, it's amazing how we can, you know, going back to a transformative experience, how we can turn our lives around and live for a purpose greater than ourselves, just like you said, Larry, self-actualization, living for a purpose much greater than just the individual. And it really is, you know, going from a selfish motivation to an unselfish one.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Yeah.
And we live in such a, still, such a materialistic age, where such a large percentage of the population really believe that the way to happiness is getting more stuff or having more material power. And yet, so many of them are really unhappy.
Yeah, if Mortimer Adler was a philosopher, that wrote many books, and one of the things he wrote about was that exactly what you're talking about, that even though we live better today than the greatest Roman emperor lived, we eat better, we have better, more advantages and things, even though we have all those advantages, so many people are so influenced by media and so influenced by social mores that they cannot seem to enjoy the good life which would be learning more, expanding your mind, serving others, all the good things that Jesus, the fruits of the Spirit, if we could just tie into or, you know, zero in on what Jesus taught, lift Jesus up, he could do all that for us.
Yes. He absolutely can. Jesus, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, where they tell us if a person has Christ Jesus in them, he is a new creature.
Very true.
And yeah. True.
Yeah,
so how do you, Larry, think people get a handle on that? I mean, people that not everybody, you know, gets there right away, obviously. It took many years for you and many of us to get to a place where we understood that God is just a breath away or just right there if we turn to him. How do you think, you know, someone who has never had that experience can get to that? Because it's easy to understand that, or relatively easy once you've had the experience, but before you've had any kind of experience that way, it's not that easy to even imagine that you can do that.
Yeah, I have to say that I don't know. I really would be hard pressed to say that I know any more than anybody else. But honestly, I don't see that there's an end place. Like you don't get there. You kind of like, wow, now I finally solved. I thought I found the secret of the universe when I was about 18 and found out you could actually control your mind if you'd worked at it. I thought, that's the end of the world. That's it. I got it all. But the truth is that there's so much more for us to learn. There's just so many lessons. They're so patient with us. We are so backward. Just learning a little bit kind of gives you a huge advantage. But I can't really say there's a secret word or passage. There's a story about the people that decided to climb this mountain, and they got halfway up, and they noticed there was a huge storm at the top. So they went into this cabin, and they found food, and it got warm, and they got comfortable and stuff, and they'd look out at the window once in a while and see if the storm was still going on, and it was. And finally, a pilgrim came by and said, "What are you people doing in here?" "Well, we're waiting for the storm to go away so we can climb the rest of the mountain." And he said, "There's always a storm at the top of the mountain." And that's probably the same predicament that we're in. We always want to stay in our comfort zone and not dare to take the next step up. And I guess that next step is the one that's the critical one.
I think about the fortune cookie I got with you one day, Paula. You know the one I'm talking about.
That's
where
a great
it says
story.
That
ship
while a ship is indeed safest sitting in the harbor, that is not the purpose for which ships were built.
Mm. Yeah.
And a good ship, a true ship, is built to weather those storms. And, you know, Andrea, your question made me think, to Larry, made me think that, you know, the real key to the to having a, an experience, a transformative experience, is the sincerity of the person who really wants to be transformed. Mm. And even just one sincere prayer, you know, along those lines, I think.
Well, and being at the place where you're ready to have that experience. And
yes.
It happens to everybody at different times and in different ways. And to come up with any kind of a formula, and I commend you, Larry, on trying to avoid answering that question. because
wisdom
I really
in not
think
answering.
That,
ah, grasshopper.
Ah,
okay.
Okay.
Very wise man.
Yes. You passed the test.
But let me ask you a question. Okay, these great experiences, that's true. But doesn't everyone that here, haven't you had peak experiences of some degree where you
Absolutely.
Felt this great elation and feeling of everything's great and perfect, even for a brief moment? That's what Maslow talked about, was the peak experience is really the evidence of things beyond our ken, that we see beyond the material world. But haven't you all had those kind of, I mean, smaller peak experiences?
Sure.
Absolutely. Sure. And like you, I never forget what I thought. You know, you say when you pass the hospital the second time, you thought something. For me, a characteristic of a peak experience is I'll never forget what I thought at that moment. Exactly what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I also know that my peak experience, or that moment for me, was specific and personal for me, just as it was for you, Larry. And that experience wouldn't have been appropriate for anybody else but you. Like the gentleman said, we're both exactly where we're supposed to be right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, someone else being there talking to you wouldn't have had the impact on you that he did, and you being anywhere else wouldn't have had the impact on you that it did. And that's one of the wonderful things about understanding the concept of really a personal God, is that everything is personal. I mean, it's all, I mean, I don't mean it that way because everything isn't personal, but I mean that in this pursuit, it's different for every person. And so in response to Andre's sincere question, it's like sincerity is something that comes to us, or that we are at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And we go in and out of those stages of sincerity at various times in our lives. It doesn't seem to me that it's a constant for anybody. Even the most self-actualized person still, I mean, if he hasn't fused yet, still has that those vacillations, those fluctuations in experience.
Even Jesus did.
Yeah. Yeah, there was Gethsemane.
I mean, the human condition is very, very challenging, very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And he did have his moments.
Well, and so that begs a question, doesn't it? Because maybe, you know, what this question and what all of this has led me to is, you know, how did Jesus try to handle, you know, the toughest decision or prayer in his life in Gethsemane? It didn't work exactly the way that he thought, but he gathered three of his friends around him and said, come and pray with me. And it strikes me that a few places in the Urantia book, they talk about the dangers of isolation and the fact that we all need
others to hear our aspirations lest they die. And it's, you know, loosely paraphrasing a lot of that, but it gets around the same theme. No man is an island, and we all need to have each other. And that brings me to a brainchild you had many, many years ago, Larry, and that was to start the Living the Teachings group that we used to meet in. And could you maybe talk a little bit about that experience? I'll be glad to chime in at some point, but what was your idea behind starting a group of people that weren't there necessarily to talk or study the Urantia book directly, but what was your idea behind a Living the Teachings group?
Yeah, what we actually, I guess what actually happened, we kind of got, we did so many study groups and stuff, we kind of thought, okay, we've done this, been there, done that, we've been talking to each other so long. Is there another way to do this? And we decided to try to do a Living the Teachings group, is where we would simply talk about our spiritual progress. And as you know, Andre, we went through many transformations of that group. I mean, people came and went until we finally got a core of people that kind of got it and understood it. And we've actually loved each other, and we prayed for each other, and we hoped for each other's success. And we were able to speak frankly about our progress spiritually, and without being morbid or mundane or, you know, just boring. That this was a dynamic that was taking place. And as you know, Andre, in that group, there was some wonderful progress made by different individuals there. And I kind of got, for myself, it was helpful because I kind of got to understand what it meant to love someone else in a different way than this just some abstract idea, but that the person there talking was talking from their heart and trying to say, look, I don't have all the answers. I wish I did, but I don't. I just want to tell you guys I'm striving to do this or striving to do that. I haven't given up. Those kind of things were inspiring because you felt that, gosh, I always said over and over again that there are no experts on the Urantia book. No living person, human being, can claim to be an expert in the Urantia book. Now, a lot of people disagree with that, but I still believe that. And I think that there's a story. Each human being has a story that is awesome and heartrending and beautiful and has all these marvelous embroideries on it, a life that we can't even conceive of, complexity and victories and failures. And, you know, if an angel could speak to us today, it'd say, well, look, Andre, look, you've moved mountains. You've done incredible things. You've snatched victory from the jaws of defeat over and over again. So what's the big deal now? And that kind of human knowledge you cannot get except in a group, maybe where you're talking to a safe place where you can open your heart to people and it'd be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It took a long time to get the right people in that group.
The safe place, I think, is key.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So safety was key, and part of it was, you know, there were certain founding principles of the group, and they're pretty logical and pretty straightforward. One was, you know, what was said in the group stayed in the group.
Mm.
We didn't talk about, you know, who was attending the group or who wasn't attending the group necessarily, you know, at least not without their permission. You know, so there was an idea of people were there, they got together and they shared what was going on with them, and part of, I know what part of my experience was that, you know, I got to, you know, since we both were members, I'll speak about you, Larry, you know, I'd hear you share about what you were going through, and all of a sudden, you know, this guy I admired,
you know, who I knew was doing really remarkable things in the Urantia movement, I saw, wow, you know, he goes through some real struggles. And I was moved to share some of my struggles. And so it wasn't like we all led and said, hey, oh, what a good boy am I, or anything like that. It was more a matter of, you know, where the rubber was hitting the road. How were we struggling? What were some of even our material issues that we were dealing with that were coming up over and over that seemed to be stumbling blocks? And, you know, you setting that group out and you know, at the beginning we were meeting weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to attend the group. We just started the group. I started a job, and all I could think about the first year that I was working a morning job on Sundays was, I can hardly wait to the day that I don't have to work this job so I can go to the group. And about a year later, you'll remember, I rejoined the group after you'd been meeting already for a year and stayed with it ever since. And it was a transformative experience. And wherever I can share that with, whether it be your Urantia book readers or anyone who's on a spiritual path, the idea of getting together with one's fellows and being able to share exactly what is going on with you takes away the sting of isolation and is an encouragement and hope. And of course, you know, we had some people that were, you know, had some wonderful gifts and would lead us in meditation, and it was just wonderful to be able to return to the group week after week and be filled and move on in our walk toward God. And I'll share as well, one of the precepts that we had for the group was we encouraged each other, and we acted sort of as accountability partners for each other about our meditation practice. How much had we been showing up, and not even meditation, more loosely than that, how much had we been showing up to spend time with God on a weekly and daily basis? And it wasn't so much like, you know, confession time or anything like that, but it was more a matter, I knew I was going to be coming into the group, and would I be able to say that I'd been conscious or made a good effort to try to spend time with God that week? And it all helped us to improve our prayer and worship time.
Mm. Yeah,
right.
I think you're right. That was a very good group. It was a successful group for about 10 years, I guess. And then we, of course, moved away from Boulder. It's kind of interesting, too. You made an allusion to Jesus needed that kind of personal friend to be around. He had always had two apostles as companions. And he was the creator of the universe. So I think what you're saying is very valid.
Yeah.
Another kind of interesting thing I should say is, and I know people don't particularly care for this, but a lot of people don't. I've said over and over again that there's no expert on the Urantia book. And when we left Boulder, we had a good gathering of people. And somehow it came up as who is the greatest teacher of Urantia, or the greatest Urantia, or whatever. And it was very interesting. It kind of got into the weeds. And I finally said, look, I think the greatest Urantian was Mother Teresa. And she didn't have a Urantia book. I mean, her theology was so screwed up and so wrong. I could go on for hours about it, but she lived the truth. And if any of us ever get to that level, then we will be maybe the greatest Urantia that ever lived. But I think right now she is. But
well, I have to agree with you. We're all works in progress, actually. And, you know, we're all trying our best to live the teachings. But, you know, it's when the rubber meets the road, when you're faced with some difficult human, typically, that you find yourself really struggling.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
to get to that place where, you know, you're centered and peaceful and calm and willing to be helpful and forgiving and all of those things. And it's always in other relationship. The thing that strikes me about the fruits of the Spirit, they're all about relationship. You can't possibly manifest any of those things except in relationship with other persons.
It's one of the things that so clearly delineates this this teaching from so many of the other traditions that exist in evolutionary religions on our world, with so many of whom, or so many of which, kind of exalt the monk experience or the isolated experience of finding God, you know, on the lonely mountaintop or off by
in
yourself
the cave.
And in the cave. And yes, we do need to spend time alone with God, and that's a really valuable thing. But if we dedicate our lives to being alone, we completely miss out on this vital experience of intimacy with other personalities. And we're told, especially in the Art of Living paper, that intimate contact with other personalities is actually an insurance against evil.
Mm. Very, very true.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good opportunity to say to our listeners, you're listening to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen, and we are interviewing Larry Mullins on the book that he and his wife Joan Batson Mullins have written, Chronicle of the Life and Teachings of Jesus, The Greatest Story, 7 BC to AD 30. And we're running out of time. We're down to 8 minutes, and we should remind our listeners that Larry's going to be back with us next week, and hopefully Joan can make it next week too. It would be so great to be able to talk to you both. And we're going to continue this wonderful discussion. And Larry, it's just so great to have you, because you have such a body of experience with the Arantia teachings, but not only that, you with life. And you're just what my friend Jen Siegel would call a person who is interesting and interested. And I adore that about you. And my hat's off to you for the 20 years you spent on the Chronicle of the Life and Teachings of Jesus, because we were talking earlier about never giving up, and you really never gave up on this. And look at the beautiful result. And I would like to tell our listeners, please do go out and buy this book. It's available on Amazon.com. And give it to somebody. If you are more than familiar with the teachings of Jesus, then make this a gift, because this would be a beautiful gift. Somebody I talked to recently said, David Cantor, he said, I'm going to buy 10 of these and give them to everybody I know for Christmas. I thought, wow, that is a great idea, because this would be a splendid gift to give to somebody. It's just so well done. And
it looks
great
wonderful.
Work.
That's very, very sweet of you to say that. I really appreciate that.
Oh, it's true.
Well, and
thank
you for not stopping digging at 99 feet.
Yeah, thank you, indeed.
What'd you say?
I said thank you for not stopping digging at 99
okay,
feet.
Yeah, thanks
for
going all the way.
You know, it's funny, when I was in art school years ago, this girl said to me, it's funny how many people quit last semester, there's so many fewer people. And I said, I don't know, maybe they're lucky. I said, I wish I could sometimes. Because sometimes you just can't. I mean, just something just won't let you quit. So I was very, very lucky. I think they said, this poor guy will never get it unless we do this or unless we do that and help him along, because he is so lost. And I think that's what saved me many, many times.
You know, Larry, one thing that comes up regarding the book, since we all want to do introductions to the Arantia book whenever that's appropriate, you know, for anybody that has the level of interest. that's required or just wanting to get it across. How do you recommend using your book as a tool in that regard? How would you perhaps use the Chronicles as a way of introducing somebody to the Arantxa book?
Well, this is real important because this is one of the reasons we wanted to have it for the mainstream. And I wish I could answer your question. In fact, I really need people to give me input and suggestions here. We've been thinking about should we go to the, take it to the different churches and show it to them? Should we go to the newspaper and get a big review of it? And we are still thinking very hard about the best way to do that. Should we send a copy to somebody like Huckabee, who talks about religion now and then is a minister, might put it on TV? Things like that are very tempting, but then I'm not sure if we have the answer to that yet. If you think of a way, if you say, okay, all you do is just hand it to somebody and say, and let Jesus lift. The idea was lift Jesus up and he'd do the rest. So we're kind of waiting around to see if
people... Well, I would think the Wild Goose Festival would be a really good place for you to be.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I mean. If one of you can get an idea like that and test it and say, hey, this is the way to do it, this is what worked, I would love to see that. I mean,
it also occurs to me that Andrea Barnes has actually been listening in on the program, and she... for the fellowship, I don't know her exact title, but she does introductions of the Arantxa book all around the country and maybe even out of the country, and has tons and tons of ideas about doing introductions. I'm wondering I don't know if she's seen this yet or whether she's looked at it, but I can't imagine that she wouldn't have a dozen ideas or more once she's had a look at the book and seeing how it could be used. So
yeah, and we're able to give discounts. We can get a few copies at a time. I can give a discount to somebody that wanted to do that, but because it's print on demand and Amazon sets the price, we can't set the price at all. But man, I'd love that. That'd be fabulous.
Oh. Tremendous.
It would be wonderful to have this book at booths because I think, you know, obviously the Arantxa book is a tome and you open it up and it's just all words and a lot of them and, you know, it can be daunting. But to have this and these little snippets where you can just go in and read a little article, Jesus Departs Nazareth, you know, Nazareth, January AD 21, you know, and just read two paragraphs and go, I think this would be invaluable to have for booth outreach.
I hope so, too. And, you know, one of the things, too, encouraged me was this philosopher. I was scared to death that the philosophy would be beat to death by some brilliant philosopher. But the very fact that we fine-tuned it the way Joan recommended, that stick to the Arantxa book, don't try to put your own thoughts in there, just stick to what they said. And these philosophical discourses, he said they were absolutely perfect.
Wow. That's really a great.
That's why.
Well, and go to Amazon, friends. If you order the book and if you read it and you love it, go and put a review there. It's really helpful. Those reviews, you know, review
make
the
all
Arantxa
the difference.
Book. Yeah, go and review the Arantxa book at Amazon. Say how much you love it. Say how much it's meant to you. Those reviews are really helpful, and they do help push those books up in the ratings at Amazon. So.
Yeah, they're precious.
To you.
They really make me—they make tears come to these old eyes, which don't happen very often.
And we have God's Gumshoe saying that he'll use this book on the Cosmic Citizen on his Sunday program, where he goes through the life and teachings of Jesus, how it is in the Arantxa book and how it is in the Bible. So that should be interesting as
well. Yeah, this is the kind of stuff we want. We want to interface with the mainstream faith.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think with some of the things that are happening with the mainstream faith, there's some really exciting things on the horizon. I think that we have a lot to be excited about.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in your input on that, Crystalyn. I know that you have some contact with that, and that we'd be glad to work with someone.
Well,
really, we can't thank you enough. We're down to our last 15 seconds here.
Okay. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate all of you.
And you'll be back next week, right? So we'll get to carry on this conversation.
We'll carry it on
like
next week.
Like a bad cat to come back.
Yeah. Tune back in, friends. You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, and we're glad you tuned in, and we'll see you next week. And until then, we'll just say bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye for now, everyone. Thank you, Larry.
Bye.
Yes, thank you, Larry.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind